Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
All right, y'all, Scott Horton Show. I'm him. On the line is Jason Ditz. He is the news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. Keeping track of any and everything for you there. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. Two big wars to cover, Yemen and Libya. First, Yemen, if we could. I've been following this one all along, and even I'm having trouble keeping track of whose side or who all's side America is on at any given time in the various different wars taking place in Yemen. Is that the right way to say it? Could you please help illustrate for the people who are the major groups fighting and what all is America doing about it?
Well, I think it's fair to call it two separate wars in Yemen right now. Of course, the war that began over a year ago when Saudi Arabia attacked Yemen to try to reinstall their former president, fighting the Shiites. And in attacking the Shiites and forcing them out of several smaller cities, the pro-Saudi forces didn't necessarily take everything that they could. And they left some pretty large cities more or less undefended, which led us to our second war. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula swooped in, gained a lot of territory early in this war. They presented themselves as being kind of allied to the Saudis, although not formally, because they don't like the Shiites either. They took multiple provincial capitals, a major port city of Mukalla. And now in the last month or so, some parts of the pro-Saudi coalition are starting to notice, wow, this Al-Qaeda affiliate's getting pretty big. Maybe we should actually do something about them. So the United Arab Emirates is leading this secondary war against them, trying to take back some of the cities that Al-Qaeda gained earlier in the first war. And the U.S. is being very public about how they support this second war, but they're also involved in the first war. And in both cases on the side of the pro-Saudi forces. So they really did play a role in this war that led to all these Al-Qaeda gains, and now they're playing a role in the war that's trying to roll those gains back.
Jesus. At this point, I guess the surprising thing is that they're trying to roll the gains back. Which just goes to show how far the rabbit hole we've already gone down here. Sorry for the poor grammar, but I think you take my meaning. And now this is a QAP that was really grew up in the first place in opposition to the drone strikes against it, right? It was basically started from nothing when Obama started bombing it. Here we are.
Historically, Islamist groups haven't had a lot of traction in Yemen as militant forces. Former President Saleh, who used to be leading a very bloody war against the Shiite Houthis, although ironically he's been more supportive of them since the Saudi invasion and since the Saudi airstrike blew up his home, he was pushing for a lot of the sort of ideological brethren of what became Al-Qaeda to move into the north, into the areas around the Shiites, to try to sort of reduce their influence.
Yeah, you gotta love Yemeni politics, where this is the same guy who had fought the Houthis, four or five or six different times, and is now allied with them in the fight against the Al-Qaeda guys that you're saying he had allied with when he was supposed to be fighting them, when he was allowing the CIA to hit him with drones.
Well, and he had allied himself with the Saudis to some extent during his decades in office. But then when the Saudis blew up his house, things got a little different, and suddenly he's not so pro-Saudi anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, this whole thing is completely amazing. And by the way, let me know if you know any different than this, but the best I know is from Gareth Porter's work on the subject that there's actually no proof at all that the Iranians have ever armed the Houthis, and that according to Gareth, even the scant evidence that they ever had was based on a UN report that talked about two different ships being seized that had guns on them, but in neither case was it clear that these were guns that were meant for the Houthis in Yemen at all. And so actually, as far as I could tell, and I've also seen, you know, expert after expert say, gee, yeah, no, there doesn't seem to be much of a relationship. But, I mean, that's the excuse for all this, right, is that the Houthis are the sock puppets of Iran, and that's why they must be confronted.
That's the public excuse given to the West, certainly. And you're right, there really isn't any evidence that it's actually happening. The couple of ships that have been seized were seized sort of south of Yemen in the Gulf of Aden, which you'll note is not where the Houthis are based anyway. That's where the pro-Saudi forces are based. But they'll seize these ships that have some limited weapons on them. God only knows where they're actually going. It's, I mean, and the fact that there are Iranian ships carrying some weapons doesn't necessarily mean they're the Iranian government. But, I think the excuse was never a very strong one, and I don't think you see it too much in internal Saudi rhetoric. There it's more a question of just Sunni versus Shiite. That a lot of this really is just an overtly sectarian war.
Well, and it's notable too that just to bring this up, it was in the one big piece that the New York Times finally did on this war, where they really talked about the debate, the way the Obama administration themselves characterized the debate, their internal debate to the New York Times, was that they knew it wouldn't work. And they went ahead and gave the go-ahead to do it anyway, basically as a sop to the Saudis after the Iran deal. That, you know, we'll go ahead and help you with this, because, of course, they couldn't even do this war without the Americans holding their hand every step of the way. And that they knew it wouldn't even work. I forgot the exact phrase. Indeterminate. It'll be an indeterminate outcome or something. But, yeah, an indefinite one, in other words.
Right. And that's, I guess, if anybody is comfortable with open-ended wars with no likely military victory, it's certainly the U.S., because they've got plenty of experience in those. But, right, even as the Saudis were talking about, oh, we'll have the capital city taken over in a couple of weeks, and we'll have the whole country liberated within a month. The U.S. certainly realized that wasn't going to happen. I think a lot of people who note that Yemen was never a particularly well-unified country, and taking it over to install a new government basically requires taking over every single little city and town in that country. That's not a small task. And groups like the Houthis are not small groups that are going to just be rolled over by a foreign military. This is something that's going to take years, possibly decades, if it ever works at all.
Yeah, them Saudis ought to read Randolph Bourne. Don't they know that war is the health of the state? I interviewed a Yemeni journalist a few weeks back who said, you know, I'm not a Shiite, but I'm sure as hell a Houthi now. We're all Houthis now, buddy. You know, just like George W. Bush's approval rating was at 90% after 9/11 happened on his watch. But Americans said, well, whatever, that's aside. His failure aside, we're all together on this, was what that approval rating meant. and you know, against whoever's our enemies. And that's exactly how the Yemenis feel about the Saudis, of course.
Yeah, it's not surprising either when the strategy consists of airstrikes overwhelmingly against civilian neighborhoods and a naval blockade that's kept the bulk of the country on the brink of starvation for almost an entire year now.
Yeah, well, you know, that's another thing that the journalist had told me, Arabi was his name, was that, you know, hey, when the UN says 5,000 or 6,000 have died, forget that. I know personally of more than that who have died, and I know that it's been a lot more than that who have, too. And he was also talking, you know, spoke to the deprivation and the malnutrition and the everything else. Do you have, can you recommend us best sources on the real humanitarian crisis there? Because, I mean, you know, they talk in 3- and 4-digit numbers here, the so-called international community, about this war that's been going on, you know, full-scale air war for a year.
All right. There really isn't, there really aren't good numbers for it. And I think we're probably not going to get a good idea of how many people have died, how many people ultimately will die in the war until it's over. It's going to be one of those situations like the, well, the last U.S. occupation of Iraq, where the official government figure was, you know, 10, 20,000 people have died, and then you have studies saying, oh, no, it was more like, you know, many hundreds of thousands, if not over a million.
Right. Well, and it depends on whether we're talking about those, you know, specifically exploded to death by the bombs we're dropping, or whether we're talking about, you know, those who die at a checkpoint on the way to the hospital, or just, you know, drinking filthy water and getting cholera, or, you know, the excess death rate during a time of war, you know, is separate.
Right, and in Yemen, that excess death rate has got to be enormous, and we're not hearing figures on it right now, but just the fact that there's been a naval blockade since the war began, and Yemen imports 90% of its food, common sense would tell you that death rate's got to be enormous.
Yeah. And it's just amazing how this is not, I mean, obviously it's an election year, and nobody really cares enough about Yemen to make it a campaign issue, but man, it seems like somebody'd make it some kind of issue, but this is really way under the radar, this war, right?
It is, and I think a big part of it is that it's Saudi Arabia. Nobody wants to get too far on the Saudis' bad side. We saw the what happened when Congress started talking up a bill that might actually hold some Saudis accountable for 9/11, and how quickly that got dropped when the Saudi foreign ministry threatened to collapse the U.S. dollar.
Yeah. Wasn't that interesting? You know, I just read, I finally read that Ben Rhodes profile thing in the New York Times, and they said his brother, Ben Rhodes is the national security advisor, I think, or whatever his position is. He's at least de facto national security advisor. I think he is a national security. Anyway, his brother runs CBS News, which relaunched the push for the 28 pages with their report on 60 Minutes the other day. And they didn't say explicitly in the article whether we were supposed to make some kind of causal connection there or not. But then, as you say, that whole effort has been backed down now because they threatened to sell all of America's debt.
And
all they
and
hold,
ironically, if this was a couple of years ago, the Saudis probably couldn't have done that. If this push had happened in 2014, the market for U.S. debt was a lot stronger at the time, and they probably couldn't have gotten away with it. But the U.S. has been antagonizing China over the South China Sea island building efforts throughout that period, and it's led China to start selling down some of their own even larger holdings of U.S. treasuries. So the U.S. probably could have absorbed a mass Saudi sell-off, but they can't with China in the middle of a sell-off themselves. It's just too much, and the treasury market just can't bear it anymore.
Yeah, good stuff there. Interesting. So now back to Yemen real quick. They had some peace talks, right? But then whatever happened to that?
Well, there have been peace talks. The pro-Saudi side, the former Hadi government...
Wait, by the way, you've been writing a lot of this financial type stuff lately, published different places other than antiwar.com. Can you tell us about where we can read that stuff too?
Yeah, mostly it would be at seekingalpha.com. I also had a piece about the war on the U.S. dollar and the American conservative about a month ago.
Great. Yeah, I read that one. Seeking Alpha and the American conservative. Okay, yeah, that's a good deal because, well, as you guys can tell, he's really good on this financial stuff too. Oh, he's an Austrian school guy, right? Okay, right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right. The peace talks had been going on. They hadn't been making a lot of progress. The Hadi side, which is the pro-Saudi side, because Hadi is the former president, who they insist is still president, withdrew from those talks last week, claiming a ceasefire violation from the Houthis. Now, what happened in this case was the Yemeni military sort of fractured when this war began. Some of them were pro Hadi, some of them joined the Houthis, and there've been a few of these military bases that are just operating as completely independent factions on their own. Well, one of these independent factions that's supposedly neutral in the war attacked a Houthi town, raided it, and stole a bunch of supplies. So the Houthis sent troops in and took over the base. And the Hadi forces are treating this as a ceasefire violation, even though that neutral military base was never part of the ceasefire in the first place. So it's kind of a flimsy excuse to back away from the talks for a little while, but early indications, despite the UN saying everything was promising, was that they weren't making a lot of practical progress anyway in the talks, so I think this might just be their way of either trying to put pressure on the other side to make a deal or just backing out of the talks for now entirely.
Man, yeah, that's such a shame because I guess, you know, like you're talking about, the task of conquering the entire country is a fool's errand, probably for the Houthis too, even at this point. But
right,
there's certainly no chance that the U.S. and the Saudis are going to have their way, especially when, as we start this conversation, they're now half-assed distracted fighting the Frankenstein they've created in Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, their enemies' enemies.
Right, and the Houthis never really had serious designs on taking over the whole country. Their focus was, well, mostly beating back an offensive against them in late 2013, early 2014, which ultimately led them to take over the capital city in, very late 2014. Having done that, they tried to negotiate some constitutional reforms. They tried to get some sort of unity government that got the pro-Houthi politicians into the government. That didn't make any progress, and eventually Hadi just resigned and left rather than make a deal with them. But I think the Houthis' ideal was a constitution, some reforms and elections. I don't think they ever really had serious designs on trying to take over all of these tribal areas around the country that were only nominally part of Yemen to begin with, and certainly wouldn't be welcoming of the Shiites suddenly showing up in their neighborhoods.
Yeah. Well, so I wonder if there'll ever be Yemen again for a long time now, but
I think the end result now is probably more than likely going to be a split, a north-south divide like we had during the Cold War.
Yeah,
we're already starting to see some of that happening. Hadi, who has gained control of one city, basically. Aden is from the southern part of the country. He holds what was the capital of South Yemen, and we've got reports in the media of groups that were formerly the Banned Secessionists going around rounding up northerners in Aden and chasing them out, saying that they're a threat to national security. So I think at some point this is just going to be de facto new South Yemen, and the Houthi territory is going to be North Yemen again.
Well, and then in South Yemen, then you still have the split between the Al-Qaeda types and the socialists, right?
Right, and that's going to be another problem. But
and is that a big territorial split, or they're all just mixed up together?
Yeah, in some cases it's a territorial split. You have the Al-Qaeda forces in certain tribal areas where they control pretty good chunks of territory, but in a lot of cases it's just they're both there in the same towns, and even in Aden, which has nominally been under pro-Saudi control for the better part of a year now, you still see Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula holding parades in parts of the town. There are some parts of the town that the security forces just can't get to, or when they try to, then there's a big gun battle, because Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and other Islamic factions hold parts of the city.
So back to the ground troops here and the war against Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Do we know yet, Jason? Did they say, I guess we don't really know, but have they admitted how many soldiers they've sent now for this new mission against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula? Because that's a pretty significant step up from just the drone war against them.
It is, and officially it's less than 100 is the only number we've gotten. Whether that's even true or not, of course we have no way of knowing. We've seen official figures in Iraq for how many ground troops we have turn out to be just complete nonsense and off by thousands at times because the U.S. just chooses to count who they choose to count as ground troops.
Right. And then I love the way your wry sense of humor in all your stuff. Sometimes you don't even mean it, I think, but troops were deployed 2 weeks ago, officials say. To me, that is just perfect. You know, Terry Gilliam, deadpan, the driest humor. By the way, we invaded a country a couple of weeks ago, guys, and this is not even the headline. This is just the subline, like, oh, yeah, well, we're just letting you know.
Yeah, it's... Well, and that's been the case with U.S. troops in Yemen for a long, long time. The U.S. officially didn't have troops in Yemen throughout sort of the early part of the Hadi government's actual reign. And then one day there was just a report, some of the U.S. troops in Yemen got in a gun battle in Aden with some Al-Qaeda forces, and a couple of U.S. troops got killed or something. And this was long before these new wars started. Well, not long before, but maybe a year and a half before. And the interesting thing about that was they had never announced that there were any U.S. troops in Yemen to begin with. So then they announced that some U.S. troops got killed fighting on the ground in Yemen, and then a few days later they confirmed that there are U.S. troops in Yemen. And they insisted, well, they're just special forces. They're just there to be targeting for the drone strikes. And when the Houthis took over, they basically all left, officially at least. And there were some big stories at the time, of course, trying to vilify the Houthis, saying, oh, well, the U.S. troops didn't even have time to take all their equipment. They just had to flee and make a mad dash for the airport to get out, although there's no sign that the Houthis were making any serious pressure on them to leave, other than saying that they didn't particularly like them. And now, once again, we hear, oh, the U.S. troops have been back for a couple of weeks. We just never got around to telling anybody about it.
Yeah. And again, I guess, embedded with the Hadi government, who, as you said, the Hadi government and the Saudis have apparently found the Al-Qaeda guys useful, and the Al-Qaeda guys tried to not make too much trouble with them for the last year of this war, where we've been flying, at least de facto, as their air force against the Houthis. But now they've decided, you know what it was that made them decide that, oh man, this is getting out of hand here, we better go ahead and pull the plug on this?
I think it was fighting in Aden that kind of provoked this. There were a few cases of parts of the port, which is, of course, for a huge city like that, is a big part of their economy. Parts of the port were just controlled by Al-Qaeda, and they were collecting taxes on parts of the port and denying them to the Hadi forces.
Oh, and that was what started it, huh? Tax collection. Always the way.
There was some fighting over the port itself, and then in the days that followed, they moved against the port at Mukalla, sort of shut down the port, and then...
Well, you know, Jason, those Al-Qaeda guys have always been the most difficult to negotiate with. All right.
But they know how to run a port.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe they got some expertise from Al-Shabaab down there across the bay. All right. Now, hey, let's talk about the disaster in Libya briefly here, if we could. I don't want to keep it too long, but I guess last I heard, there are supposedly three governments there. I wonder, is that right? And are any of the three of them actual governments of anything? And what is the American role in escalating the fight in Libya these days?
There are at least three governments. You could say there are dozens of governments. There are three that actually have claims to be a national government, and there are a lot of them that claim regional power. And in most cases, the regional powers are the ones that have actual control over some territory. In practice, of the three national governments, the Tripoli Parliament is probably the strongest. It's also the only one that's not officially UN-backed. But it's got a lot of the former Muslim Brotherhood members are in it. It's got support from the Misrata militia, which is one of the more powerful factions in the country. And it's got control of, well, most of Tripoli, along with Misrata and sort of that little surrounding area, which is not a big chunk of the country by any means, but is a lot more than the Tobruk Parliament, which basically controls Tobruk and has a few military forces that are constantly attacking Benghazi and failing, or the...
And that's the one that has Haftar, the CIA-backed guy, right?
Right. And then there's the third government, which is the brand-new government, which controls basically a naval base in Tripoli, and that's it.
Yeah, that's the unity government that has no allies with anyone anywhere. Controls nothing. It's a good name for it, though. I got to admit that. All right, so now what about the Islamic State? Because Donald Trump says we got to bomb them and blockade them and bomb their oil and get rid of the Islamic State in Libya.
Well, Islamic State in Libya, I guess you could argue, is a fourth government, because certainly they have designs on eventually taking over the country. They control basically Sirte and Raish Lanouf, which is a big oil port part of the country. They could have a lot of oil shipping out of there if the international community wasn't blockading it. They've also made some gains toward Misrata, so they're on the one hand facing offensives from all three governments and several other factions, because everybody sort of sees that getting Western support means being the best one fighting the Islamic State, but they're also gaining territory on their own here, so I don't think these mostly feckless governments can really do much to them.
All right, so, well, speaking of feckless governments, what about the U.S. and the U.K. and the French and their spies and special forces? I've been hearing this and that about certain missions there.
Right, this is another one of those, officially we don't have ground troops in Libya, but we have some special forces going around figuring out who would make the best allies. Britain's got some troops there. Italy's got some troops there. France has got some troops there. France is another one that doesn't admit to having troops there. They insisted that media reports were about them having troops there were false, and then when one of their major newspapers published leaked memos proving that they had troops there, they started investigating who did the leaks because they didn't like that.
Well, that makes sense. But so are they lazing targets for planes or not? What are they doing?
Right now, it's not really clear what they're doing other than wandering around, meeting with different local and regional factions and seeing who might be a good ally. The official invasion seems to be on hold for the time being. I think everyone's sort of waiting and has their fingers crossed that the unity government's going to get at least enough support locally that they can be counted on to give an official go-ahead for an international invasion so they can say they have the support of at least one of the official governments. But in the time being, they're just sort of wandering around, and British and Italian troops ended up getting attacked by ISIS last week. There were reports of a few troops killed in that. There were also reports of some of them getting captured. We never really got a good official answer of what happened there because these are special forces. They don't like to talk about what they're actually doing, but again, right now, it doesn't sound like they're doing much.
And now, so who controls the oil fields? They're almost all in the east of the country, right?
Right, and it's complicated in Libya because a lot of the oil fields are inland, and they're just in empty desert. And a lot of the, of course, all the exporting is on the coast. So a big issue is who controls the coastal cities that are doing the exporting. Like Benghazi is under the control of an Islamist group that's not really affiliated with anybody else. They're the Shura Council of Benghazi. Raich Lanouf and Sirte are controlled by ISIS. Tripoli is mostly controlled by the Tripoli Parliament. But the oil fields themselves, it's mostly local factions, tribal groups that control the literal sand around the oil fields. So the Western investment in Libyan oil that came right after they ousted Gaddafi really hasn't borne a lot of fruit.
Yeah. Well, at least they get to keep selling bombs and planes and that kind of thing. So that's something. Oh, and by the way, you know, I made a swipe at Donald Trump there. I should mention Hillary said we should just invade and stay in Libya forever, like we occupy Korea, Japan, and Germany for 70 years, whatever, since the end of the Second World War. So, yeah, pretty much nothing worse than that, as long as I'm mentioning, you know, partisan politics and stuff. But that, in fact, what she said in the debate was, well, yeah, you know, everything was going fine except for Libyan obstruction of our efforts to help them, which ended up ruining everything.
Well, right. And what really happened in Libya was that there was no organized opposition the way the U.S. was presenting it when they intervened. There were a bunch of rebellions going on against Gaddafi all through the country, but they weren't. They were never this unified force that they were being presented as. There was an official sort of, I guess they called themselves the LNC, which was the supposedly the national coalition force, but they never really controlled a lot of the combatants, and they just sort of hung out in Benghazi during a lot of the fighting. So, I don't think there was ever a realistic chance that ousting Gaddafi was going to lead to some sort of unified Libya.
Yeah, it's really amazing going back and seeing, well, in the Hillary emails and from other sources, just what these kooks were telling each other as they were launching the war that I know for a fact you were explaining the truth about in real time all along, including to this audience, mostly at news.antiwar.com. But we knew from the very beginning that there were veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq from Iraq War II among the so-called rebels. We knew that, there was no reason to believe this was going to all, result in some 21st century Western European capitalist democracy or whatever the hell, like they've been trying to build in Afghanistan all this time. The whole thing was the slowest motion train wreck since the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And yet they kept doing it anyway and kept telling each other congratulations on how great it's going. What a tremendous victory that the most powerful nation ever was able to send enough mercs and terrorists to hunt down and kill some tin pot dictator. Hooray! It's just like that time when George Bush found Saddam Hussein in his spider hole. There were no spiders in it. No one knows why you're supposed to call it a spider hole, but you have to call it a spider hole. And anyway, once they got Saddam, then that was it. Everything was great. It was a great victory, and everybody knows that. Congratulations all around. Mission accomplished. And then now look at this mess. And yet, when you read the emails between Anne Marie Slaughter and Hillary Clinton, I mean, it's really as dumb as in the second worst accusation against them, right? When the first worst is that they did this all on purpose.
Right. And I think a lot of this in Libya was brought on by the early part of the Syrian civil war, which was going on at about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That the European Union was in the process of, or had already, I'm not sure about the timeline, boycotted Syrian oil because they were protesting the crackdown against demonstrators. And a lot of these Western European oil companies saw Libya as the most natural replacement for Syrian oil.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
So they said, well, there's a rebellion going on there too. If we can just real quick oust Gaddafi, and then we can just have ENI and whatever other European oil companies got contracts there go in and start pumping, then we don't need Syria.
Amazing. I had not realized that part of it at all, that the cause and effect there. It makes perfect sense, though. Definitely I'll have to read up on that. You know off the top of your head, where's the best place to read about that? Or just news.antiwar.com?
Yeah, I think, I don't know that there have been a lot of single articles that go into that, but just the timing of it was certainly noteworthy.
Yeah, well, definitely note taken here. Got my attention with that one for sure. And only because it confirms my bias. That's how these things work. Every stupid thing they do just means they have to do something else horrible, too. Otherwise, look at the consequence, which they keep anyway. But anyway, thank you, Jason. You're great, man. I really appreciate you coming back on the show and sharing your nightmares with us here. I hope we could do it again soon. Catch up.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. All right, y'all. That is the great Jason Ditz. News.antiwar.com. A lady asked in the comment section under my last Tom Woods interview, yeah, but how does Scott Horton know all of this stuff? That's the answer. News.antiwar.com. I read Jason Ditz all day, every day. And you can also find him at Seeking Alpha and the American Conservative Magazine. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms.
This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.